The following episode was recorded in front of a live streaming audience on Sunday, November the 2nd, 2025.
You know who you are?
Steven is my name.
Even Steven.
Will you say something, Steven?
Steven or else media.
You're listening to the Superman Super Show, episode number 92, The Yellow Plague. Hello and welcome to the Superman Super Show. I'm a host. My name is Steven. And 1,000 miles over there to my right is another host, Mr. Ed Moore. Ed, how's it going?
Hola. It's going pretty well, sir. Pretty well.
Any crazy events happening in your neck of the woods?
Well, I mean, we're recording just a couple of days after Halloween. So there was everybody's Halloween stuff. The wife made an observation that I have to say that I've seen, but it just didn't strike me because I haven't worried about trick-or-treaters for many more, for a while. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's been this shift, at least around here, from the parade of children walking up and down neighborhoods, knocking on doors, trick-or-treating, to either the parking lot trunk-and-treat things, or festivities indoors, whether it be in a shopping mall or close if it's like a strip mall or something like that. So the craziness of people wandering around of the neighborhood for, you know, 2-3 hours has been condensed to much more controllable environs where they can be watched and guided and controlled a little bit more. And I had never thought about it, but yeah, that seems to be exactly what's happened. Rather than, you know, all of this expansive happenings, now the happenings are very condensed and squeezed into certain areas.
Yeah, I remember you talking about this last year that you didn't get very many trick-or-treaters.
We didn't get any this year in our little... Now, I will say, we live in a little spur of the street, it dead ends, and from the nearest intersection to the dead end, there are 4 houses. So, I mean, it's not... Now, at that intersection, if you go in one direction, you get regular style neighborhood. So, there's houses on both sides of the street. There's probably, 10, 12, maybe 15 houses until you get to the next intersection, and it continues beyond that. There's like 3 or 4 intersecting streets on that road. Not necessarily our specific locale, but a couple hundred yards from us is a typical residential established kind of neighborhood.
Yeah.
I don't know if kids do it there and they just don't come down our little spur, or I bet that they probably don't at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah, we just turned out all the lights and watched Shaun of the Dead. But I looked out there every once in a while. I didn't really see anybody. So
the house next to us used police tape. They've got poles on either side of their driveway, so they ran police tape across that.
Nice.
And they police taped their porch off.
That's a good. I'm going to do that.
And it's like, is that decorated? Terry looked at it. She's like, no, I don't think it's decoration. I think she's saying leave her alone. I was like, could be too.
Do not fucking disturb.
It's because in order to do anything, you'd have had to break the tape to get there. And it's like, I guess that's what she's doing, is just saying, no, not me.
So, yep.
But the funny thing is like, well, but you did it in the affectation of the holiday. So how do we know that's what you meant, or were you just...
Exactly.
So
I saw on YouTube, I was watching Electric Callboy put out a new video, and after I watched it, it took me to a like somebody had, you know how people will do their Christmas lights on the outside of their house to music using the computers and stuff. Well, this was the same thing to an Electric Callboy song, but they were Halloween lights. So I guess people are doing Halloween lights now, like Christmas lights. So that's pretty interesting.
I was at a recent higher level community function where they're talking about things to do to engage people. And I brought up, you know, Halloween is huge now. Maybe it didn't used to be, but it is huge. You can go to places where towns do it for the weekend. I just recently heard of a town on the way to Myrtle Beach that everybody pretty much has to drive through to get to Myrtle Beach. Do you know Myrtle Beach? Do you know the?
Oh, yeah.
Do you recognize? Okay. And I can't think of the name of the town, but they do Halloween the entire month of October.
Wow.
They have themes and they have little festivals and store things. They highlight different things every weekend, but through the week, you know, the stores will run different specials and stuff like that. But the whole month of October, because what they're trying to do is everybody drives through them to get to Myrtle Beach. And they're like, well, what can we do to get people to stop?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, let's try a Halloween theme thing. And for the month of October, they indicated loosely, I don't think they have released like all of the information they have, but loosely, they're stopping people increased to 40,000 people over the month of October from what it had been. I don't know if that was the previous year or this was like the fifth year they did this. So maybe it was like before we did it and it's gotten up to 40,000 this year or whatever. But so Halloween is huge. And unless you really pay attention, you don't necessarily notice that there's a lot of people. Probably half the houses around here have either inflatables or something signifying Halloween.
Yeah.
So it, you know, it's out there if you look.
Hmm. Cool, cool, cool. Yeah. 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 All right. Banter complete.
Next.
We still need a now sound for that shakunk, something like that. Like a vault door closing. Clink.
Well, you can look up the, what is it, NCIS SVU?
Oh, yeah, the dun 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 dun.
Yeah.
Dun dun. Yeah.
It's supposed to be the closing of a cell door, and I'm like, I don't think that sounds like any that I've heard.
But like a couple of notes on a keyboard of some sort.
Yeah, like dun, dun. It's stuck or something. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. Well, today we're looking at the Yellow Plague. This is the third of four Superman tales that appeared in Superman number 11. It was written by Jerry Siegel with art by Leo Nowak. Superman number 11 has a cover date of July/August 1941. But according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics at mikesamazingworld.com, the issue hit the stands on May 2nd, 1941. And here is what happened in the story. Metropolis is gripped by a terrible plague. Superman learns from Pedro Carlos that the plague originated with the Churoba tribe. Clark, Lois, and two explorers seek the tribe in search of a cure. The tribe has been taken over by Quismato, the high priest, and a gangster. That is a terrible sentence because Quismato is not the high priest and a gangster, but the tribe has been taken over by the high priest Quismato and his partner who is a gangster.
Right.
So, clear that up.
Maybe gangster by association.
Yeah, maybe. They release the plague in hopes of extorting money. Superman stops their plans and rescues the son of the slain leader, Wacouches, which is the son, not the slain leader. We never learn the slain leader's name. Clark and Lois then return to America with the cure. By the way, that synopsis also comes from Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Ed, what did you think of this story?
I enjoyed this probably as much as any of these Golden Age Superman stories we've read to date, because it reminded me of a frickin' movie serial.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
For a variety of reasons, but a couple specific reasons, which may be show a limited exposure to the movie serials on my part. I mean, I know they were made in volumes, all different styles of serials and everything like that. But the ones that I am, that always come to mind when I think of those 30s and 40s movie serials, have a couple plot points, story points that this story has, and I'll point those out when we get to them. But it very much put me in mind of the early movie serials. Also, at some point, and I forget when it was, I thought that it felt like I had been reading this story forever. So I actually had to look and see how many pages I had read and how many pages the story was. And it's a typical 14-page story for these Superman out of the Superman book stories. Now, the action stories may be a little longer, a couple pages. But so it was so full and had me so focused that I just had not realized that truly I had only read 10 pages or something like, you know. It just seemed like it just kept going on and on and on. I'm like, this can't be, but it was. It was just a normal length story.
Yeah, this is one of those that they just pack a crap ton into these 13, 14 pages.
And it worked. It wasn't like a crap ton just to fill. For me, it was a crap ton that really kept me invested and turning pages and reading and looking. Yeah, so.
While I will agree, there were two distinct moments in the story that took me out of that completely. And we'll talk about those when we get to them.
Alrighty, so we have the Flash. Yeah, I don't know. It's
News
Superman
Flash.
And it's Splash. So there is no Flash here. The Splash page was it was a little bit smaller this time. It was maybe about 60-65% of the page. It has been like a three quarters with maybe just one little panel.
Yeah.
But this, the smaller panels at the bottom, they needed more room.
Heck yeah, there's a lot of text down there.
There's a lot of text, yeah. So the splash image kind of reflects something that occurred in the story. The way that it's drawn, it kind of throws you off, though. It looks to me like all three of these individuals have fallen and Superman is flying to rescue them.
Hmm.
I believe the intent is that they are standing on this reddish ledge, throwing her over.
Yeah, into the volcano.
Which would more match something that happens. But if you just look at this image, it doesn't look like they're standing on there. It looks like they have fallen over also. With
yeah,
Lois.
I can see that.
Yeah, so... Yeah. So we open at a hospital, right? Yeah. Yeah. We're at the hospital because Lois and or Clark,
I don't think they really make it clear.
No, it says both of them, I guess. So, they are doing research. They're at the hospital to speak to Dr. Sanford Frank about whatever is going on or Sanford Franklin, sorry, whatever's going on. That is centered at the hospital, which from the first panel, we don't really know yet.
They're sent to provide, to write up color.
Sorry. Yeah.
So just a fluff piece basically about the interns who work at the hospital.
Right. I'm sorry.
They must have spelled intern differently back then because I don't remember intern being with an E.
No. I-N-T-E-R. Intern. Yeah, no, I guess ours, we just dropped the E now, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. So it was intended to be a fluff piece, but when they get there, they find out they're right at the beginning of something.
Yep.
That turns out to be much more pronounced than, well, right before they, you know, all this happened, what was going on didn't exist. I mean, they're right at the forefront of learning something is happening, and it involves the doctors and hospital and everything
like
that.
One of a couple of coincidences that happen in these types of stories.
Right. Hence the name of the story.
Yeah.
Which is moderately off-putting, but not, I mean...
Yeah, I will just say real quick, when we get to the disease itself, because in this opening bit here in the splash page thing... What does it say? It says a malady that grips hundreds.
Sends terror screaming through the streets.
So the dread illness, which first renders man repulsive in appearance and then transforms him to a raving maniac.
Yeah, but they didn't really touch on that as far.
No,
yeah.
they couple of times in the story, they make reference to the fact that their skin turns yellow.
Yes.
That's it. That's the horrific.
Right.
Yeah. That's why they call it the yellow plague.
Part. Yeah, I guess. So.
I don't know if that's supposed to be a racist dig at the Japanese or
who
I don't
who
know.
Knows? Yeah. You know, you're talking 1941. You're talking predominantly Jewish creators, maybe not completely. You're talking about America. There are whole lots of reasons that something could be innocuous, but could not be. It's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah.
Which way you want to lean? Do you want to assume good or do you want to assume not good? And so it's, yeah.
But isn't there is it kidney failure, something with your kidneys that can cause your skin to look yellow?
I know that there is a situation involving your blood that makes you look, they call it jaundice.
Yes, which jaundice.
It's a yellow tint.
Yeah,
I believe that's blood. What is that? Because they put you under UV light as a baby to correct that. So is that something too many white cells and they congregate and cause your skin? Something. It's something that is not present in your blood, I think, that ultraviolet light corrects.
Yeah.
And it changes from a yellowish tint to the more, whatever you want to, white, Caucasian, off-white, whatever color you want to say typical North American people are.
But I do feel like I'm going to look this up real quick.
European people, I guess, actually.
Because I feel like it's also a sign of either liver or liver problems.
Could be liver. Okay, yeah.
Yellowing of the skin, known as jaundice, can be caused by varying factors. Okay. Liver problems, blood disorders.
Okay.
So there we go.
Yeah,
and also some crazy thing from tribe in South America can
wherever, turn your skin yellow. Yeah. Babies that are premature, a lot of times they're jaundiced.
That's where you hear about it more often.
That's a standard thing. Yeah. That was me. I was born a month early, and my mom, I believe she should have been diagnosed with pre or eclampsia. I forget.
Yeah.
But I don't know in 1968 that was necessarily a big deal that they, I don't know where medically that diagnosis was, but my mom had the symptoms, and also I was born a month early. So between the two, I spent about 6 weeks under the sun lamp at the hospital before I got to come home.
Nice. Okay.
So, yeah. excuse me. Okay. So Lois and Clark are here. We're meeting with Sanford Franklin, who is a doctor and a friend of Clark. But we also will meet a gentleman by the name of Pedro Carlos, which I guess when you're white and you're writing other names, you use two first names as the...
Yes.
As well as some of these other names have a smacking of whiteness to them, intending to sound other, but it's like
they're trying really hard, but they just haven't quite.
That may be me. Maybe if someone from Central or South America read these, maybe it would.
Yeah,
they would be like, "Oh, okay, well that's a pretty good effort." But me, I'm like, I worry that they're doing something that they're not that good at, and it shows that they're not that good at it. So, Dr. Franklin is rushing out with Pedro to help someone, and Lois and Clark tag along. At first, as you mentioned, probably the fact that Pedro is with them kind of piqued their interest because he is listed as being an intern, and that's what they're writing about are the interns at the hospital. Pedro is an intern from Latin America, and that is the extent of, I think, where we find out that the rest of the story occurs, Latin America. In my mind, when someone says Latin America, I think they mean Central America, but they could also mean part or all of South America as well. Yeah. So that's like two-thirds of the world, north to south, that this could occur in. So I guess that's all we need to know is it's not here, it's south. We'll run with that.
And I think Pedro Carlos does specify a little bit later, South America.
Oh, does he say South America?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. We'll see.
Okay, well, all right. So they get to where they're going, where the call has come in. There's been a call. They rush out to the location of the call. And right off the bat, Pedro Carlos looks at the patient slash victim, whichever you want to call it, because it's going to turn out to be a disease that this individual has contracted. And he says the word Chiroba, Chirroba, Chirroba. And, you know, he's, Clark notices and makes a note and then asks him, what, you know, what is that? What is Churoba? Well, for whatever reason, I don't know what's going on, maybe, or he is just trying to be a male sexual organ to Clark, but he doesn't answer him. And they are easily close enough. I mean, if Clark heard him speak, he would have heard Clark speak. They're that close. So, but he doesn't answer it. Suddenly, while they, I don't know, it seems that Clark and Pedro's attention gets pulled away momentarily. Maybe there's another victim in the room or something. I'm not sure what happens, but this initial patient suddenly sits up and gets violent. He grabs a, I don't know, part of a chair, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
And he goes after Dr. Franklin. Again, it, by the way it's drawn, it almost looks like Clark had his back turned and then with the commotion kind of turns towards it and can see what's happening. But he, as Clark Kent, but using his Superman powers, he kind of moves in such a way that he trips the, yeah, see, it's got those little protuberances on it. It looks like maybe it's the top rung of a chair that he ripped off or something like that.
It was this her hat? Was she wearing
that,
a hat?
Yeah, that looks like her hat. Yeah. Because if you go to the previous page at the bottom, she's got it secured here in the middle. Yeah. So some kind of weird hat off to the side of her head, whatever the fashion was then. Who knows? Clark, but using kind of his Superman powers, kind of oops and gets in the guy's way and bumps him or trips him or whatever, so that they can grab the guy, but he passes out anyway. So, I mean, they're not, it doesn't happen like he does to this dude a little bit later in the story that I'll mention that, yeah.
It was really kind of disappointing because when they describe it earlier as, you know, the patients turn into these violent maniacs, I'm like, ooh, we might have like a fast zombie situation.
Maybe they're
hands.
Running around doing stuff. There's,
I was hoping for something like that, but then they become manic and then within moments they're dead.
That's like the last oomph of life and then they just, so they help him back into bed. Dr. Franklin gives him an inoculation of adrenaline. I'm not sure what about the situation he thought adrenaline, but whatever. They're comic book creators. They're not doctors.
It's like he was just up and about earlier. Let's give him some more adrenaline so he can get up and start smacking
and
us with that thing
again.
Some more.
I don't know. And then let's see. No, I'm sorry. It's not Dr. Franklin that gives the injection. It's Pedro Carlos, because at the time he gives the injection, he says, but I'm certain the man will be dead in exactly 3 minutes, along with what he's doing. And Clark didn't notice this. Well, maybe he did, but Lois definitely did. Because she starts watching her her watch now. And sure enough, 3 minutes later, the dude dies.
The Superman Super Show will return after these messages.
Hey there, comic fans and children of the 80s. My name is Steven, and I would like to invite you to join me on another G.I. Joe podcast. If you grew up yelling, "Yo, Joe," or flipping through dog-eared issues of G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, this is the show for you. Each episode, we're tackling one issue of the classic Marvel comic series, starting all the way back in 1982. We'll break down the stories, the artwork, the characters, the wild twists, the covert missions, everything that made this series one of the most surprisingly rich comic runs of the decade. We'll follow the rise of Snake Eyes, the schemes of Cobra Commander, the battles, the vehicles, the ninjas, the chaos, and the totally over-the-top, totally awesome storytelling that defined 80s action. Whether you're reliving your childhood or discovering these comics for the first time, I'm here to guide you through it all with excitement, insight, and plenty of nostalgia. So grab your gear and join the team, because the mission begins now. Yo, Joe!
Hi, I'm Eric, host of the Long Box Review podcast. I love comic books so much that I started Long Box Review to celebrate my love for them and connect with others who share my passion. Each month, I critique the comics I've read and present other topics, such as spotlights on specific issues, my comics history, the Legion Project with Peter Rios, where we discuss the Legion of Superheroes, and so much more. Additionally, the Longbox Review podcast feed includes The Gutters, my audio journal, and Center Seat, my Star Trek podcast. The Longbox Review website also examines comic books outside of the podcast, such as the series 52, Justice, and others. Please join me as I celebrate nearly 50 years of comic book reading and over 15 years of podcasting. You can visit longboxreview.com for more information. And thanks for listening.
And now back to the Superman Super Show.
And then we see that Clark is like, huh, how could Carlos have calculated it to the very second? So he did here also. And just, yeah. I don't know, Superman time is accurate or whatever. He knows that it's... So it is kind of fishy that this dude, he comes in, he says something that nobody understands what he says. And then he even says that something is going to happen in a precise amount of time. And it happens. So you've got a Latin American doctor who, you know, of course, in 1941, us white folk, yeah, maybe we don't know a lot about people from Latin America. He says something in a language we don't understand, so we don't know what he says. And then he says, you know, it'll be okay. This dude will be dead in 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
And so,
yeah.
So Carlos is looking, or Pedro, sorry, his first name is Pedro, is looking kind of fishy, but maybe not on purpose.
Yeah.
You know, maybe all of these things are just coincidental because there are aspects of him that we don't understand because he's other. And maybe that's what they're trying to point out, the mysteriousness of other. So here, in my mind, I'm starting to get that serial movie kind of feel because the juxtaposition of regular mom and pop heartland of America going to see a movie and seeing a serial, and it has these aspects of other that maybe in 1941 they're not exposed to, although
yeah.
I don't know what sort of immigrant labor had migrated to the central part of the U.S. in the early 40s, if that had occurred yet. I don't know. Nowadays, of course, it would be very different because we do have a very hefty migrant workforce there that white people have been exposed to over time because it's so vast and it's definitely there.
Yeah.
I don't know when, speaking of 1941, if anything like that had occurred. So in my mind, it's still white mom and pop going to watch and seeing other. He's speaking a language. He is from Latin America. He has a name, Pedro Carlos, which doesn't paint him as being white American. And now he is like, oh, does he have some kind of thing that he knows in 3 minutes this person's going to die? And he does it.
Yeah.
So, now, next, they go outside and they see sick people running around like you were thinking was going to happen.
Yeah, but he must make house calls because it says that they off drive the three to the next case on Carlos's list.
Okay.
So yeah, this would, I guess, still in the days of house calls, even in the big city.
And we've got Clark and Lois. And if we presume that two more of the people in the panel are Franklin and Pedro.
Yeah.
We have three crazy people running around then, two dudes and a woman. Although maybe the woman is just trying to escape one of the crazy dudes.
Yeah.
And maybe the dude here with the hat is also. Maybe the only crazy dude is the one running with the thing in his hand.
Yeah, it looks like to me that they just pulled up to wherever this is.
And he's, yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's another hospital. Maybe Carlos works at different, maybe he's interning in different medical facilities. Maybe. And
yeah, he's a circuit doctor like the old time circuit preachers used to do, only he's
Yeah, because at least the crazy guy is in all whites, in all white scrubs.
Right.
And there's a couple other people that are in all white, so I would assume this is some other medical facility, but yeah, they pull up as they're just bursting out the front door, just
right. Yeah, somebody's gotten loose. Yeah. He apparently didn't faint like the first patient did, but
yeah,
he is active enough, and somehow he managed to get a hold of what appears to be an axe.
Yeah,
because in order to protect the good peoples of Metropolis, an officer puts him down with a firearm. And
yeah, so, now I don't know if you're if you're looking at this panel when you read this, if you're using I guess the trade, so it's been digitally recolored or whatever.
Yeah.
Does it show the bullet explosion as red explosion? Red.
Yeah. Almost like it could be either the bullet hitting him and it going his body going pop, or it could be the explosion from the gun, whichever.
The first what I saw, I went, holy shit, that the blood splatter, his chest bursting open as they shoot him, you know? And then I realized, I guess that's supposed to be the explosion from the gun. But yeah, that looks like they did probably blow his chest open, but still.
Well, what kind of bullet would come out of that pistol that would be able to do that to a human body?
Right.
You know, at this time, I think most of those were like 38s.
Yeah.
I think it's just going to go right in. And, you know, but this is like, this is almost like a shotgun blast or something. It's like,
it's like a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Pulped his chest is what it what it looked like. It's like, dude.
Yeah, it looks really violent.
Metropolis PD is set to be putting some people down when they're running around like that. Screw Superman. We'll take care of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's violent because he just shot the guy down.
Yeah.
But it looks more graphically violent than I think they meant it to.
Which is something we really haven't seen to this point in these stories, is anybody really being violent like this. We can probably almost count the number of people we've seen actually get shot on one or maybe two hands. I mean, you see people being shot at, but you seldom so far have really seen them get hit.
Yeah.
So I guess this dude, I guess they're wanting to show us how bad it is that, first of all, they have to be shot, but then they show us, you know, it's like, oh, that's interesting. The name of the movie with the dog is Old Yeller.
Yeller.
And they call this yellow fever, and they're putting people down. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's probably just a connection in my mind. I don't know. I don't know when Old Yeller came out. Probably not in 1941.
50s or 60s, yeah.
Yeah, probably in the 60s.
Probably 50s, yeah.
So it says 3 minutes later. Now, it's interesting they say 3 minutes later. Not that it matters, because this dude got shot. So it's not the same 3 minutes of the other dude. This dude died well before the 3 minutes.
I did not put that together. I guess I didn't notice that one caption, because I went from "don't shoot, bam" to "he's dead." And so, well, yeah, he's dead. He just got shot in the chest. But 3 minutes later, whether he had the plague or not, he got shot in the chest.
Yes.
He's going to, if he didn't die instantly, he's going to die. But maybe here's a big stretch. Here's the thin line I'm going to go with here. Maybe the shot didn't kill him. He's bleeding out. It would have taken 10 minutes for him to bleed out, but the plague killed him in three.
Okay, it could be. Okay.
So technically, it was the plague that killed him, not the gunshot.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Just like when you're 90 years old, even if you're like in a car crash or whatever, you died of normal causes. There it is. Yeah. Normal, you know, it's like...
Yeah.
They got crushed in a car compactor. What? How is that? Well, they were 90 years old, so it's normal. Oh, well,
okay.
Yeah. I don't know. So again, I guess in reference to the way that this dude was acting, Pedro again uses the word Chiroba, only this time, the first time he just said the word. He looked at the dude and he said Chiroba. This time he says, he's dead, Chiroba.
Chiroba.
And again, Clark is there and hears him. Makes that mental note that, you know, there's that word again. Lois is here. She's talking about that, well, these things are more impactful than we thought. We ought to go ahead and call this in and get a story started, or call in the story as much as they have, whatever. But before they can even do that, she just mentions it. And the Wextra boy, that's not what they say, but that's what it said in my head. Comes running up with a paper of the morning pictorial, and the headline is already there: "Yellow Plague Grips City." So they can't.
Yeah.
So this must be the end of the calls,
first reel,
house calls. There we go. The house calls that you were talking about, because they are freed up, Lois and Clark, and they go back to the paper. And yeah, this would be a good breaking point for this movie. We need to get into the movie.
Yeah.
So we'll And the next serial for the movie, I don't know, that comes out whenever, next week or next month. I don't know how they did that. I've never done enough research to know how they broke them up. Although I do want to say, probably one of the reasons that I even have knowledge of serials and the way things were done like that, growing up, I grew up at a time, everybody hold on, I grew up at a time that there were like four channels on TV, because the signal for the TV came from this big stick with this big hand sticking out that was stuck on your house somewhere, okay? So we got maybe the biggies, ABC, NBC, CBS, maybe, but you always, I don't care what the situation was, you got public broadcasting.
Heck
you
yeah.
got PBS. On Sunday mornings, when I was in, probably junior high is when it was on, there was a show on Sunday mornings called, which shows you that we weren't going to church at the time, called Matinee at the Bijou.
Mm-hmm.
And the episodes were an hour and a half or 2 hours long, and they were patterned as if you had gone to see a movie. So it had a main, and it had serial, it had maybe a newsreel, if depending on when the movie came from. So it was just like the experience of going to the movies in, you know, I don't know, 1942, except you got to sit there at your house and watch everything. And it was hosted by Debbie Reynolds, I think is who it was hosted by. Matinee at the Bijou. I thought at the time it was the coolest thing. And looking back at that, I realize how historically significant being able to see that was, because even then, you know, when I was in junior high, that would have been in the early 1980s.
Yeah.
Showing things as they were in the 1930s or 40s, which even then I'd have had no idea of. Now we're eking up on 100 years ago.
That's, yeah.
What a terrible thing to come out of my mouth. But, you know, so, and so that's a lot of the old actors and things like that. That's how I was first exposed to them, was from that show, not from seeing the movie, some kind of regular run on the TV or something. And at that time, there were VHS movies that you could go rent, but that cost a little bit of money to be able to go out and rent them. So we didn't do that either. I had friends that did, but
yeah,
I had a friend, actually her dad would rent every single tape that came out to make a copy of and take it back. Because in his media room, he just had this rack and rack of VHS tapes that had the movies on them. So
nice.
Anyways, so we find out that the Daily Planet, Lois and Clark, they've been scooped. Well, Perry, either based on them or he knew already, he's getting kind of upset. Not fairly necessarily, because that's not the story that he sent them out to get. It wasn't a story then when he sent them out. So now, he's thinking that, who is this? Is this? Oh, no, this is Lois. I'll make up for it. Several prominent doctors are meeting to determine ways to combat this epidemic. Well, so yeah, epidemic. Sorry, my page turned there. So she knows that there's going to be a meeting. Well, we already know that Clark knows Dr. Franklin. It told us that they were friends. And so he calls Dr. Franklin to try to get back in touch with Pedro Carlos, because he is starting to think that Pedro knows more about something, some aspect of what's going on, or he's involved or something. But he has more knowledge than he has said, at least to Clark. And so Clark is like, well, this thing is getting bad, and I think this dude might know something, so I'm going to try to get in touch with him and pick his brain. Well, yeah, while he's still alive. It'd be easier to pick his brain while he was dead. But, but he calls and finds out, oh, dang. Pedro has gotten sick. He has been waylaid by the disease. Clark goes to him and says, look, dog, before you die, you got to tell me, what is this Chiroba? Which is kind of cruel. I mean, the dude is laying there potentially going to die. I mean, I don't know that we have seen anybody else that gets sick survive. So as far as we know, the mortality rate is 100%.
Yeah. So, you know, we'd like to think that Clark went into the room and had, you know, hey, man, I'm really sorry this is happening to you.
How you doing? People, how's
anything I can get for you, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they make it look as if he just rushes into the room. Tell me now before you die.
Yeah, there's something you must reveal, and quickly. What is Chiroba? It's like, dog. I mean,
and even on his dying, on his deathbed, he's like, screw you. I'm not going to give you something that you're just going to, just so you can get your name in the paper.
Exactly. I'm not going to tell a newspaper man this information. Yeah. Forget it. It's like, no. Which is kind of like
the page.
Kind of like the way they do reporters at the Pentagon nowadays or so.
Interesting.
I don't mean to get political. I shouldn't. I truly do apologize for that, people.
There were a couple of things I could have said in the banter, but I knew that we'd be here for another hour. Yeah. So I said, let's try to make this episode not talk about.
Focus. Stay on task.
Turn the page.
Lois is at the meeting of the medical professionals, presumably, I guess, doctors.
Yeah.
We undoubtedly will discover a cure for the disease, the main speaker is saying, but unfortunately, it may take months. And Lois, I guess she's thinking it. I got kind of confused here for a moment because it looks like a word balloon, but then it's bracketed in it like a thought bubble.
By that time,
it'll be too late, which she's absolutely right. I said, if we're seeing 100% mortality, then all the people that contract it in the months it takes to find a cure, well, they're all going to die. So,
yeah, because it's not a long, drawn-out illness. They get it, and then within, like, an hour, they're dead.
So now we go back to Clark with Pedro Carlos, and he is trying to convince Pedro to tell him what Choroba is. So he shows that he is Superman, which is kind of funny because he flashes him. He opens up the shirt, which we see. But then in the next panel, we see him fixing his tie, which means he has put the tie back on.
That's the only proof that he has to this guy that he's Superman is that he's wearing a shirt with the Superman symbol on it.
Right. He doesn't even take his glasses off.
I've tried that many times and it's never worked. Nobody has ever believed that I was Superman, but whatever.
Well, but were they on their deathbed?
No, that's true.
Okay. Maybe that is the key that you're missing.
Yeah. Maybe through deathbed eyes, they can see the truth.
You have to find that person to test your theory out. So, it's Superman. Amazing. Listen, while I explain the meaning of Choroba, so all he had to do is flash that shirt and say, I don't know what him being Superman necessarily has to do with it. I guess what they're trying to say is that because this is Superman, this man with information feels that this horrible thing can be stopped by Superman, I guess.
That's what I think.
He says, this is Pedro. I'm part Indian, a member of the Choroba tribe of cliff dwellers who live on the border of Quasmania in South. And I put some kind of accent to that. Quasmania. It's Quasmania, if you want to say it whitely,
Quasmania.
Here you go. You said in South America. So that's where Quasmania is South America, in impassable country. So cliff dwellers living in impassable country. The yellow plague is an affliction almost exclusive to my tribe. Its cause and its cure is known to the Quetaches, witch doctor cult of the tribe. So for those of you taking notes for the test later, the Choroba tribe lives in a mountainous South American country called, we don't know what it's called, do we?
It's just on the border of Quasmania.
Yeah. Quasmania. That's the country. Quasmania. I did write it down here. So he lives in Quasmania. He's part of a tribe called Choroba, which I don't understand necessarily why that is the word that comes to his mind when he sees it. But the people who know about the plague, most importantly, can cure it, but apparently can cause it also, are the Quetaches witch doctors, which is a cult in the Choroba tribe that lives in Quasmania, which is a mountainous country in South America. Okay, there are your test questions.
There will be more names for you to memorize.
Any assemblage of those. The appearance of this malady in Metropolis is of sinister significance, perhaps not accidental, Pedro goes on. Clark says, then the cure for the dread yellow plague can be secured from the witch doctors of your tribe, eh? There's one of your favorites, eh? Peering through the window, lost in thought, Clark is not aware that Carlos has crawled from his bed, a mad light gleaming in his orbs. So here he is. He's gone over the edge. He's gone into the frantic portion of the illness. Clark is thinking, if I could pay that tribe a visit, speak to the witch doctor, but before Carlos can actually attack him, he like passes out on the way, like across the room.
Yeah.
And at that point, Clark realizes what's happening and catches Carlos. He's dead, and he kindly lays him on the floor after catching him rather than putting him back up in the bed.
Yeah, but yeah, that's like, weird.
Yeah. Oh, it's too late. Lay him on that.
Yeah.
I could almost
it's more like,
envision
it's more like
him
he just
dropping him.
Yeah, it's more like he just let him drop. Yeah. Oh, well, shit.
Yeah, there we go.
Here goes that lead.
So now Clark, with this information, goes back to the Daily Planet, and he's going to beseech Perry to allow him to pursue this information that points to a cure. When he gets to the office, though, we find that, conveniently, I think using a word that you have used several times, a Mr. Carl Van Breeden is there, and he is a scientist explorer coming to offer a reward to whomever can conquer the terrible disease. And he's not offering the reward to whomever. He's offering the reward to whoever,
which
I believe the correct word would be whomever.
Yeah, I don't think we could trust this guy.
Yeah. So he is going to leave. Now, here we, in my mind, are getting into full-blown serial territory.
Yes.
We have to go to South America. We have some regular people. We have, at the very least, a financier, if not a guide. We don't quite know. He says he's a scientist explorer. So I would think that he's a guide, but he's there to offer a reward. So maybe he's more the financier who would be sitting in the helicopter drinking margaritas while his companion was down wrestling the tigers, as we used to see in 70s Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. That was the difference in job titles there.
I have to sing the song now.
Mutual of Omaha is people you can count on when the going's rough.
All right. Thank you for that.
Well, you only heard that song like three times every Saturday growing up, you know?
That was...
Because, yeah, if you watch Wild Kingdom, you heard that song many times. Yep. And God knows there wasn't a lot else to watch on a Saturday.
Was it Wild Kingdom, a PBS show also?
I think so. We always watched it over at my grandma's, because that's when we would visit my grandma's. So it was always on there.
Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. So Clark asks Mr. Van Breeden, would you be interested in joining the expedition for We Intend Forming? He says, I'd be delighted. Lois is like, when do we start? And Clark's like, what do you mean we, white woman? And she's like, yeah, dog, you ain't going nowhere without me. You could forget that. And she's, I like the next panel. She basically says that in one panel. But the next panel, you see she is leaned up against the desk, her feet out and her hands on her hips. And you can almost see her head shake when she says, it's settled, I'm going. She almost bobs there. So,
yep. Now, there we Carl go. Knows. He knows.
He's recognized the posture. He knows women, and he recognizes this posture. He says, no use arguing with her, Kent. Yep. I can see she's bound to have her way. Which, of course, at this point in their relationship, Clark knows that too. But he's got to try to talk her down from going to South America in search of a cure for a plague. I mean, that doesn't sound like it's the safest, most comfortable thing for anybody to be doing, much less a woman in the early 1940s. Yeah. It's, you know.
The Superman Super Show will return after these messages.
The Outcasters starts a bold new direction by covering Avengers Under Siege with Earth's mightiest podcasters. Outcasters Under Siege, coming in 2026, only on the Right On Network.
Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2.
In 1961, in the pages of issue 123 of The Flash, Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash of Earth 1, travelled to another dimension, met Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash of Earth 2, and the DC Multiverse as we know it was born.
And in 1985, after many years of cross-dimensional adventures, DC Comics published the cataclysmic Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the DC Multiverse was gone.
But did you know that Barry Allen's Flash was not the first hero to meet a version of himself from another dimension?
Did you know that Jay Garrick wasn't even the first Golden Age character to return in the Silver Age of comics?
The scope of the pre-crisis DC multiverse reaches far beyond Earth 1 and Earth 2.
And the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters is a lot wider than the heroes you know like Flash, Green Lantern, Sandman and Starman.
On the Earth 2 podcast, we navigate the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse of universes and other dimensions.
And we celebrate and explore the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters, including the legendary Justice Society of America, and a lot more besides.
So join me, Peter Watson.
And me, David Steele, and our occasional guests of friends, family and fellow podcasters.
For weekly dramatic readings and analysis of the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics.
On
the Earth 2 podcast.
Transmitter cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.
And now back to the Superman Super Show.
So they jump a plane, I guess. I don't know. Breeden had one waiting and whatever.
This would be the moment in the serial where we would see the map and we'd see the red line
the jumping.
Going from Metropolis, yeah.
Right, yep. They refueled here. And you would see, if you look ahead on the map, you would see there's nowhere for them to land because there's like, you know, places. And then you're like, oh, now they're just going to go into, deepest, darkest, It's not Africa, it's South America. But anyways.
And it's funny how, and we'll see this when we meet the gangster that's working with this tribe. Nobody, Clark, Carl, whatever his name is, Lois, nobody dresses for this expedition.
No.
I mean, they're just wearing the same suit and ties and hats and pumps and they're going to a cliff dwelling tribe in South America. I don't know. I find that very funny. And then of course, again, when we meet the gangster, he's just in a suit and his tie and just all gangstered up. And I find
amongst
that very
the tribe
weird.
That looks very tribal.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He is. Yeah.
I just find that weird.
So they go to South America and Van Breeden hooks them up with Major. Of course, he has to be a major in the British Air Service, I would suppose. Major Burt Crandall of the local Air Corps. Yeah.
Love that name.
In search of advice. Now, in the serial, Clark would not be the big name. Burt Crandall would be
Hell
the big
yeah.
star.
Yep.
That's you know. Now, we probably, if we were watching, would have seen snippets of Burt in South America, knowing that that's where we were going. But yeah, Burt Crandall is the star of the piece. I mean, with that name, you can't,
He's the barrel-chested hero.
Exactly. Now, Lois would still be the main femme fatale because she's going to fall for Bert because he would rescue her or whatever, whereas Clark would maintain the foppish kind of, you know.
I 100% agree with you until Superman shows up.
Well, that's.
If this wasn't a Superman story, if it was just two reporters and a scientist explorer, then this guy would be the hero.
But, right, yeah.
And he is until Superman shows up.
So he talks to him, tells him, well, you know, where we're going, we're not going to be able to take the plane. And I think this is cool. But we do have blimps and we can take one of the blimps into this, you know, more mountainous area and everything like that. And I just thought that is way cool. 1940s, because blimps hadn't been around too long by then. Nowadays, I don't know, they would make some souped up there, but it's like a blimp.
Yeah.
Very serial, because number of things could be written into happening on the blimp. It, you know, So they're in the blimp flying. They encounter some weather. The blimp starts to ice over. To the extent that the blimp is having a really, really difficult time staying aloft. So it looks like if things keep going, they're going to crash before they even get to where they're going. So they're going to be stranded somewhere, you know, wherever this thing goes down. Clark, he doesn't even make excuses. He just finds a way to separate himself. And of course, in doing that, he changes to Superman, goes outside on the blimp, breaks off the ice. I don't know. I guess physically, unfortunately, we could have seen some like I-beam action here or something. They didn't use the opportunity. We could have seen him grab a hold of the blimp and blow to propel the blimp faster out of this weather. We didn't see that. He just rapidly, the Man of Steel clears the aircraft of ice in the space of a few moments. And that,
I have no idea how
it says
how he does
that. Yeah, it doesn't show us. But, as he did that, the blimp had been so affected that it ends up striking a nearby rocky outcrop, mountain peak, what have you. So it is damaged before he can completely do what he tried to do. So now he reverts to just straight up rescue mode because the blimp falls. He goes and he saves the blimp from crashing at this point, changes back to Clark Kent Duds and goes back into the people part of the blimp, capsule, I guess. Yeah, the cabin, whatever.
I do want to point out real quick on this page, the Superman panels on this page and the previous page, Leo Nowak's use of the way he has the cape act in the wind, mm-hmm. especially on the page where he's standing on the blimp and the cape is kind of wrapped around a fin.
Right.
I like that. Yeah, we'll see it a little later. I think it's this story. It might be the next one where the wind actually has the cape blown over his head. It's almost covering his face at one point. It's pretty interesting.
I don't remember seeing that. Okay.
It might be the next story. Yeah.
Now you mentioned that and I have to say I was rather disappointed to a large extent in the art in this story.
Yes. I think we talked about this last time because he did all four stories are Leo Nowak.
Mm-hmm.
And while he does interesting things that aren't typical as far as poses and panels, he's not a striking artist.
It's very open rendering.
Yes.
There's not a whole lot of fine detail. Now, like you said, the large details are cool because he does different kind of poses and he's doing things with the cape. And so the big view is entertaining, but the details are almost non-existent. Yeah. And so the rendering just is very open. The faces almost merge a lot of times with background because,
you get more than three people in a panel and it's just like, who, unless, you know, if Lois is the only woman, she's the easiest one to pick out. But otherwise, sure. It's like, who are all, especially when you get gangsters and people who are all dressed in suits together.
Speaking of the woman, what about the woman in the next story that lost the pearls?
The woman who looks a little like a man?
She looks rather masculine, I was like, dude, come on. Yeah, so, but that's the next story. So they're down. Right. They've landed, although they didn't necessarily want to.
And it is neat to see him catching, in essence, a blimp.
Oh, you know? Yeah, sure. I'm not sure how many times he's caught a blimp.
Right. It's not often we see him doing just really massive feats of strength. Every once in a while, you know, pick up a train or something, you know.
Right.
But
yeah,
it's neat. I like that they did that.
So inside, they're catching Clark up with what Clark doesn't know, but of course what Superman already does know, kind of thing. Then we hear a radio report. The strange plague which has struck Metropolis increases in ferocity, is spreading out over the entire country. So, while they're trying to fix things down here in South America, things are getting worse at home, is basically what we're told.
Yeah.
Clark is like, well, we're not where we wanted to be, so let's go ahead and strike out on foot to get there. And the captain, which this may be Reed, Was that his name? I didn't know. Or Bert. Reed Crandall. Who is Reed Crandall?
Bert Crandall.
Reed Crandall is a superhero.
I'll look it up.
Who is that? Is that the, not that spirit? Reed Crandall? I don't know.
Reed Crandall is an American illustrator and penciler of comic books and magazines.
Oh, okay. That's where, okay. He's a cartoonist. Okay. Bert tells him, no, you know, it's nighttime. Walking around in this land at nighttime is just insane. We can't do that. So they sleep, and it's not even touched. Is there sleeping quarters? Did they all just sleep in seats or what? It doesn't matter. Yeah. They slept. Next morning, Clark takes off. Van Breeden assists Crandall with the blimp's motor. So Bert and Carl, Van Breeden, or Crandall and Van Breeden are working on the physicalness. Lois is doing woman 1941 things. I don't know. And Clark is, well, of course, we know what he's wanting to do, but he's just making the excuse that he's just going to go, since he's not handy anywhere else, he's just going to go walk around, look around, see if he can see anything, you know, whatever. Just an excuse to, again, separate himself from the party. He can't be useful like the other two men are. Obviously, he's doing that so he can become Superman and they won't know, and he goes and does this Superman thing. So he leaves them, assuming that they're going to be okay, goes to find the Cherobus, and he does find the tribe, using his X-ray vision to kind of scope out the lay of the land, if you will. He sees a young boy who is sitting at a fountain about to be accosted by three other villagers and a smartly dressed suit and a fedora man who we'll find out is a gangster.
Yeah, I didn't notice that the first time he kind of, with this scanned copy, he kind of blends in.
Well, yeah.
His suit's the same color as their skin.
So you've got two tribesmen over here, and the one in the very back is the chief, or the acting chief, or whatever he turns out to be.
Yeah, the witch doctor or whatever.
Yeah, and then the gangster. Now, this young man is going to turn out to be the son of the chief, but that is not his dad that is pictured in that in that panel. So they're up to something. So Superman swoops down just as they grab the boy, rescues the boy, in essence. In the process, he throws some of the tribesmen around a little bit. Cool thing here, of course, being South American and being an other tribe, well, they use poison darts. I mean, they always blow them through the straw, and that's how they, you know, that's their big weapon. And so, of course, they pull one out here and try it on Superman, and it just bounces off.
Yeah.
I say that to just show that they are using some of those standard kind of tropes that were, they're still used at times nowadays, but they were used then, you know. So rescues the boy. The boy tells his Superman that his name is, you pronounced it Wacouches.
Wacouches.
And that's how it's spelled, but that is straining just too non Spanish Central American. Yeah, I'm not sure how I would.
My brain reads. Yeah, my brain doesn't pick up on it. It always sees. I just read names like that phonetically. Period.
Oh yeah,
and
W A C O U C H E S. Wacouches. Well, yeah, absolutely.
But it's got to be something. It's got to be pronounced a different way.
In their head, when they were writing it, they probably heard something other than Wacouches. Although,
yeah.
Wacoche,
Wacoches or something like that.
Wacoche or something. Yeah. I don't know, you know. Son of Choroba Chief. So there we find out that this is the chief's son. Superman flies him out away from the village, sets him down, and flies back. Well, no, he doesn't fly back to the village. He decides he needs to hook back up with Lois and crew to see how they're doing. I guess he's been away long enough that Clark needs to make an appearance. As he's going there, we see them before Superman gets there and find out that they are trying to hold off a pack of starved wolves, because well-fed wolves would not be attacking them like this. So the wolves must be starved, which I guess shows you that how bad this part of the country that these tribes people live in are. There's not even food for wolves there. So So they're firing pistols, trying to hold them off. They've retreated to the higher parts of the cliff, of course, elevation, because the wolves can't climb. So they think. And then Superman comes up and he starts kicking and throwing the wolves around, whatever, dispersing the pack that was attacking them.
Flinging them away by their tails, it looks like.
Slinging them. And this is the first time that any of them have seen that Superman is, whatever, watching over them or in the area. We have seen Superman several times before now, but they had not seen him. So now he says, okay, you guys are good. I know, you know, I saw Clark, so I need to go back and make sure Clark is all right so that he can come back. So that's how he goes and switches back to Clark and comes in to the picture as Clark. The same set of evil villagers that had tried to kidnap the boy has found these white people holed up somewhere that we don't have white people. So something is going on here. So they, the quote unquote bad villagers, attack the blimp. They attack the blimp with an arrow on fire. And the first thing that occurred to me was the Hindenburg disaster. If you've ever seen video of that, I think it would have happened a lot more explosively here than what they showed, simply by using a, you know, maybe not, but I thought of that and I'm like, I don't think it would have been this nice, that they just lost the blimp. I think it would have been more like that video reel that I've seen.
Yeah.
So they escaped the blimp, which, probably what the intent was to destroy their transportation. That's what they were trying to do. So the tribesmen did that. We have a little conversation about how bad it is for our Lois and Clark group. And then the final panel on the page, we see that this tribesman is being controlled, maybe, by a typical gangster of the time. So much so that the tribesman was going to fire to try to kill, fire on the survivors, our group, to try to kill them. And the guy said, no, we don't want to do that right now. And my presumption was that this is the same gangster dude that we saw in that little panel where they were running after the boy. Okay, so now we focus on Lois and Clark, Bert and Carl. I see that Bert still has his hat on. Actually, so does Carl, which I think if they're fussing, climbing, it's very exerting, hot and humid, that would have been probably one of the first things to go. Boy,
that's why that is the mark of a true hero, is that they always know where their hat is. Which is why Lois, or why Clark, has lost his hat, because he's a coward.
Or Superman doesn't need one or the other.
That's right.
So a little catch up here. They've been moving, working, climbing, you know, variable terrain. Oh, it's so difficult. Well, they also don't have any fresh water. So that is starting to weigh on them, not being able to rehydrate. It's an appropriate time for them to go to sleep, whether it's actually night. I mean, you can never tell in these cartoons because it's all fully lit, but either they're just so tired that they're going to sleep, or it's actually nighttime, but they decide to rest. Clark tells Lois to go ahead and go to sleep to take her mind off of being thirsty. The group is being watched by the gangster-led portion of the tribe. And the tribesman we see here is wearing a very Viking-looking headpiece. I don't know. Maybe the Vikings had visited. I don't know. He's got a necklace on, and you can tell he's not. He's got some kind of non-traditional white man kind of clothing on, but it's not colored particularly well. You can't really tell, other than they did make it a point to put that he had a loincloth. He was wearing something. He's not the naked savages that we always hear about. Yeah. He is the clothed subtribe of savages with a spear, of course, a spear, nasty horns, no shirt, very tribey.
Yeah.
Superman, while everybody's asleep, is looking around trying to find them fresh water, and he decides to do that body drilly thing, which they show it, but I still don't quite get the feeling of him corkscrewing into the ground. But that's what he's doing.
I totally did. And I was like, Ed Fein, because we just talked about it in the last episode.
Yeah.
Ed got him corkscrewing into the ground.
Yeah. But obviously, that's what he does down to. He spotted water. So I guess he's doing that artesian well kind of thing if you tap into it. Because in the next panel, actually, the next couple are pretty funny. The next panel, he like rushes over and wakes everybody up as Clark. Look, suddenly there's a hole in the ground and water is gushing up out of it. These weird things happen in South America. And in the next panel, our group is waylaid. Oh, now there's two gangsters. Is waylaid by the gangster-controlled tribesmen, or if they have the whole tribe, whatever. But we see tribespeople, we see a couple gangsters assaulting our people as they are simply trying to get water. So what are they doing? They have stretched out on the ground to lap up the water from whatever crevices it's running through. That is, well, actually, now that I look, I see, I guess this blurb here down at the bottom is the water coming up. That's the fountaining water. So they have come to it and they were, we have Bert and Carl who are laid out.
Bert looks dead.
Sucking it out of the ground almost. I mean, they're just, you know, they're making no play of how thirsty they are. They just went in face first. Lois and Clark, I don't know that they actually had the chance to get down there to the water before the bad guys waylay them. So it's
a very funny panel to me, because not only do we have like Bert looks like he's dead.
Yeah, he's just face down.
We get a bit of dialogue that apparently happens off panel, because the narration says rapidly they appease their terrible thirst, but suddenly a booming voice causes them to look up. And the first thing we see the gangster say is, "I said, raise your hands." So he said that off panel. We just didn't hear it. I just think that's funny.
At least one time, if not multiple times. And yeah.
They're going, drinking. And he's like, "Raise your hands. Raise your hands. Damn it, I said to raise your hands."
Yeah. It's very, so they were very thirsty.
Yeah.
So now the tribes people led by the gangster is taking everybody to their homes. The Cliff Dwellers Village of the Choroba tribe. When they get into the village, they see the king. I guess that's what you're going to call him, the high priest. No, I don't know. I'm kind of confused as to who this dude is. But this dude who they first see, he doesn't look like, according to the narration of...
We don't get it until like the third panel. That would be Quismado or
that in this first panel. That's him.
Actually, no. I'm going to say no, because Quismado is sitting in a throne.
Yeah,
so this must just be some guardsman.
They note the frightened, cowed appearance of the populace, and typically, I think in this situation, I don't know that the populace would look fearful at the four intruders that are being led by their warriors. I mean, I would think that they would be kind of curious, but they would be at peace because the warriors have captured these people and they're not going to do any harm. So I thought it was interesting that they described them as frightened. Continuing on, they take them into the palace here, and you find Quasimodo. No, that's not how it's spelled. It's Quismado, Quismado. But for the first several times I saw the word, it was Quasimodo. And so I can't help but think that they were playing on that somehow, the creators, because that's just too similar. If you're just going to pull a word out of the ether to make his name, why are you going to make it look like some other very well-known literature name? I mean, that's, you know.
Yep.
The intruders are to be thrown into the Cave of 1,000 Horrors. So that's going to be their punishment for, I don't know, for being white people in the wrong place, I guess. I don't know why. So they take them there, and they see that the child, Wokoche, is there, which they don't know. But of course, Clark, Superman, does know. So he recognizes, the chief's son, he thinks to himself. He's chained to a wall. which is kind of interesting that this village in South America with native peoples in 1941, who probably have had very little connection to gangsters, has chains already in their cave that they can chain people to. Yeah, okay. To make matters worse, to keep the people from escaping that they have put in the cave, they don't chain them up, them being Lois and Clark, Carl and Bert. But what they do is to get into the caves, you have to cross a pit, a depression. How they did it, I don't know if they put some kind of gangplank across it or if they just climbed down and went across and climbed back. I don't know. But now in this pit, to make sure that they can't traverse it, they fill it with snakes and scorpions.
Yep.
I don't like spiders and snakes. Do you know that song? And that ain't what it takes to love me. You fool, you fool.
I don't think so.
No.
I don't like spiders and snakes. And that ain't what it takes to love me. Like I want to be loved by you.
And now that I've said that, I can't remember. It was a comedic gentleman that did that, and he had a variety show on during the 70s. He also wrote a song called Cow Patty. His name will come to me.
The name that Ed is searching for is Jim Stafford, an American singer, songwriter, musician, and comedian. While prominent in the 1970s for his recordings Spiders and Snakes, Swamp Witch, Under the Scotsman's Kilt, My Girl Bill, and Wildwood Weed, Stafford headlined at his own theatre in Branson, Missouri from 1990 to 2020. Stafford is self-taught on guitar, fiddle, piano, banjo, organ, and harmonica. Thank you, Wikipedia, for all of that useless information.
So, now our group is trying to find out how to get out. What devilish torture? We have the choice of dying by thirst and starvation or making a useless dash for safety through those poisonous creatures. They feel that's their only choices. Clark is like, well, while we're doing that, let's go ahead and free the boy. Since he's chained up, you know, we're free. Let's go ahead and free him too.
The Superman Super Show will return after these messages.
Do you like comic books? What about comic books from the 70s? Well, how about sword and sorcery comic books from the 70s that feature a certain barbarian from Sumeria who seems to spend most of his time wandering the earth, scoring with babes, and fighting wizards and monsters and such? If all of that sounds fantastic, then come explore the Hyborian Age and tread the jeweled thrones of Earth with me, Stephen Orr, and the Hither Came Conan podcast. Together, we'll look at Conan the Barbarian, the Marvel Comics series that began in 1970, one issue at a time, along with any other Conan comics I can get my hands on. Subscribe to Hither Came Conan now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains, like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head?
And now back to the Superman Super Show.
All four tug at the captive youth's chain, but in reality, it's Kent's tremendous strength which succeeds in snapping the metal links. And of course, you could see that happening. Two of them on one side, right? Two, including Clark on the other side, and Clark's side frees up. And then he's like, okay, here, let me help you guys with it. And then, you know, I can see that. Thank you for being kind. I am Wakochi, son of Chiroba chief, slain by Quismato. They have imprisoned me here so I cannot inherit the throne. So there we find out. Again, we already knew, if you paid attention when he first showed up, who he was. But now we reaffirm who he is and reinforce that by him telling us that they even had him chained up so that he couldn't take his dad's place. This Quismato is not the true king. Everybody goes to sleep. While they're asleep, Superman does a super thing and he clears out the poisonous snakes and scorpions, shows him throwing them. I don't know where he threw them. You would think they would just come back to...
Throwing him against the wall until they burst.
Squishing them. In the morning, it's amazing, says Bert. Super Lois tells him, gone. Could the Cherobans have removed them? If you ask me, this indicates that Superman is still watching over us. Lois, of course. So as they're about to emerge from the cave, I guess the tribe's people, the guards, were going in to check on them, and they met him right at the entrance of the cave. Clark negotiates to go speak to Quismato. And once he, or no, let's see. We have only one hope. If one of us can survive running the gauntlet, here we are back again. Any more bright ideas? Into the volcano with them. Huh. I don't know where this gauntlet thing came up. He just mentions it.
Yeah, it just came out of the blue.
So basically, it's this thing that if one of them does and survives, they get to choose what their reward is. And of course, we understand that anybody that wins it, their reward would be to free everybody. That's ultimately, so that it's not even spoken per se until later on, but obviously that's the intent. Yeah. With Superman talking, you can figure, well, Superman is going to be able to survive anything that regular people can throw at him. But to make sure that they give the opportunity to run the gauntlet to Clark, Clark insults Quismato, hoping that...
I think it's a little different.
Okay.
Clark needs to be somewhere else so he can change into Superman and come back and say, I demand to run your gauntlet.
Okay.
So he insults the guy.
You're right.
So they'll take him back to torture him. And that's when he uses that superpower of hypnosis, I guess, that he has. Because he comes back to the guards later. Remember? He comes back and he's like, all right, I'm done. You're unhypnotized. Start torturing me. But of course, they rescue him at that point.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You're right. I'm sorry.
It's so funny.
And now, in accordance with tribal law, you must grant my wish. It is that your captives go free. He tells the Quismato after having run the gauntlet, which just seems like it's a bunch of braves or villagers that I don't know. Didn't seem that there was anything particularly nefarious that they had in mind.
It's like the dance line at the Soul Train on Soul Train, but instead of people dancing, they're stabbing and hitting you.
Yeah, receiving bludgeon blows and knife thrusts. So when you're going down the line, they're more like a fraternity thing into a fraternity. It's
yes,
you can just see Clark at the head saying, following the lead. The guy says, Clark says, "I state your name." Yeah, which is
this. This is the funniest moment in the entire story. We don't see it until the next page, but I'm just warning you. I'll interrupt you at that point.
Okay. So Superman tells him what he wants, and Quismato says, "Your wish is granted, Mighty One. Now go." Scarcely does the Man of Steel soar off than Quismato reveals how little his word can be trusted. Lois says, "Saved, and by Superman, Bert." Or let's see. Now, one of the gangsters says, "Are you going to let them go free so that they can talk?" And Quismato says, "Naturally not." Guards, seize them and carry out the sentence.
So that's the funniest part of this whole issue. First of all, Superman just leaves. He's just going to trust that they're going to let them go.
Right.
So he doesn't, make sure. He just leaves, and within seconds, throw them in the volcano.
And why is Superman not going to come back and be kind of pissed that you did this to his people?
Yeah.
You know, And at this point, I'm not sure that you would really want to deal with a pissed Superman. I mean, he's done enough stuff that you're like,
yeah,
man, this dude is pretty bad. I don't think, you know.
You saw him fly away. He survived being stabbed multiple times and then fly away. You referred to him as Mighty One.
I don't know. Yeah.
It's like, all right, he's gone. Throw him in the volcano.
So they're walking everybody to the volcano, and I knew better than to trust treacherous Quasimodo, Superman says as he flies back. So I wonder if he left to sea.
Yeah.
And then came back. He knew, especially
he's floating up above.
With two white gangsters in the group. He's like, come on, man. Okay, this is what I want you to do. Okay, bye. And yeah, it's like, yeah. So he comes out. And now the next panel, Quasimodo wrestles Lois to the edge of the volcano and throws her in. So these two panels, maybe one in between somewhere, combination, that's what the splash page for the story is based on.
Yep.
Now, Quasimodo, as he's, I guess, if you envision, he's perp walking her up to the edge, and then as he uses whatever force to push her over, Superman rescues her, but the force that he used causes Quasimodo to fall himself into the volcano.
Yeah.
So that's, which, I don't know, I guess that's so Superman doesn't have to do anything to, I don't know why they wrote it that way, but that's what they did. So he falls, Quasimodo, which doesn't necessarily fix anything because there are still two white gangsters that seem to have been in charge of everything. Now, we don't see them right here, but until Superman does something with them, won't they just appoint someone else to be in charge and be a penis, or they do it themselves or whatever?
Yeah.
With incredible speed, Superman overcomes the guards with one well-swung blow, so he frees everybody else. There's still the gangster chief to take care of, Bert tells him, so Superman runs off, finds them as they are about to get into their autogyro, which I think is the first mention of that in the whole story. We never see it, so.
No.
With his henchmen, sighting Superman coming, he flings a stick of dynamite, but it bounces back, and a taste of their own medicine, as the dude at the beginning got shot. These three dudes, or maybe four, you can't, maybe there's four looking at the
body
artwork.
Body parts flying all over.
Yeah, I see four flesh-colored globes, which could be the faces. They're blown up by a stick of dynamite, so very violent.
That doesn't affect the autogyro.
No.
Because they use it to fly back.
Right, that's how they get back.
Yeah.
So Superman turns back into Clark. Clark goes back, hooks up with Lois, Carl, and Bert, makes sure everything now is okay with Wokoche, that he is in charge and he is in his rightful place, being the new king and being a friend. He says, you know, you white people can go, get the hell out of my place. You come causing problems, just go. The gangster chief's autogyro ought to get us back to civilization, we hear from Carl. And then the final panel, thanks to you, the terror of the yellow plague has vanished. Lois says, don't thank us. The person who deserves the credit isn't here. And somebody, her, or maybe all three of them, I kind of envisioned it was, you know,
all
much
three.
As everybody would laugh at the end, everybody says, Superman.
Yeah.
And that's the end of your serial.
So it turns out, as we were looking through this, there's only one moment that really kind of took me out of, you know, you were talking about how there's just so much. You just fall along. You just turn the page. You're loving all of it.
Yep.
And it's on this page.
Okay.
And it's the second panel. It feels like the moment where the writer was like, oh, crap, we forgot to tell him why they were doing this. And so they're getting ready to be thrown into the volcano. The witch doctor chief says, throw him in. And then the gangster guy goes, wait, I want to tell you something. So you came here for the cure to the plague, eh? Well, you'll be interested to know that Quasimodo and I have deliberately started the plague in Metropolis so we could later demand heavy dough for banishing it. Just got to squeeze that in real quick, just so you understand what the...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not been mentioned at all anywhere so far.
It just took me right out of it because I just realized it just felt like at that moment I could picture like Jerry Siegel at his typewriter going, shit.
Oh, shit.
We haven't talked about why they did this.
Why? Yep.
You know,
why are the gangsters there? What?
It always annoys me anyway in any form of media when the bad guy assumes that the good guy's about to die, so has to tell him what the plan was and why
gives
he's
him
doing
the,
that.
Gives him the plan. Yeah.
Yeah. It just drives me crazy. I still see that today in modern stuff, you know, that it's like that. And so we got that here, but it just seems so forced that literally they're getting ready to be dumped in. And it's not like Clark says, won't you at least tell us why you're doing this? That would have made more sense. This is the guy stopping him. No, don't throw him in yet. I have to tell him why we did this because
before
I don't know,
he
makes
dies,
me feel like
he
a big man or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah. But yeah, this was a good one. This was so far Superman number 11 has been pretty spot on.
Yeah, this has been fun and funny and this was a cool one.
It's funny though because I was when we got to the part where Superman is throwing the wolves around by their tails.
Mm-hmm.
I think about the Superman that we have today, especially the Superman that's in the movie, where in the middle of a kaiju attack, he saves that squirrel.
Oh, he saves the squirrel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the Superman that I love. And obviously, this is Superman could give a shit about animals. He's killing animals left and right in these stories. He's throwing gorillas. He's throwing dogs. Yep. He's just doing all kinds of stuff with animals. And I think about my daughter, who just because of the movie now loves Superman. And a lot of it is because of the fact that he saved the squirrel and he was so upset that Lex took the dog. Where's the dog, Lex? You know, she loved that.
Yeah.
And yet she's going to read some of this stuff and she's going to be, why is he killing all these animals?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, because he came to his senses over 80 years. Yeah. You know,
1941,
don't know.
Nobody really cared about animals back then, I guess.
Not superheroes. They, you know, yeah.
It's not like he's just randomly choosing animals to kill. They're animals that, quote unquote, are dangerous. They're attacking them. But
And it has been only to protect people. Yeah. So it's not like in order to get, although the snakes and the scorpions, maybe, in order to get somewhere or to get past the animals, he has hurt them. It's almost always been animals that have done something or are doing something to people that he has to save. Now, the snakes and the scorpions, that might be the first time that he's done something to animals that really weren't doing anything to anybody. He just did it to get rid of them, literally, to get rid of them. So,
yeah, and with the wolves, you know, he could have flown down there and just kind of used a super breath to just push him back a bit.
He could have
dug a big trench between them and the,
in a way that only they could hear.
Scared him off.
He could have done a thunderclap. He could have,
he could have carried all three of them away.
Could have just carried, picked them up and carried them away. Yeah.
But yeah, this is one of those stories that you really get the feeling that he had to make sure, the writer had to make sure that there was something they had to overcome. If not on every page, then every other page, because as much as being packed into this and as much as they jump over things that they probably should have shown, there's that whole sequence of him clearing the ice off of the blimp.
Right.
That not only did we not see him do it, it didn't need to be a part of the story, but it's just one more danger that they had to face that Superman had to save him from. So it's just like danger upon danger stacking up. You know, that's what makes a good serial.
A lot of things that Superman had to do.
Yeah, exactly.
That, you know, they, yeah, so.
Yeah. So, good story.
Yeah. Very, very entertaining. Very entertaining.
All right. Any last thoughts? Anything else you want to say about this one?
What is this? Issue 11? Issue 11. Good. Anybody that has access to this, and who knows? I mean, they keep making those, what do they call it? Where they're taking the old books and printing them again and selling them.
The facsimile editions?
Now, this is only issue 11, so by itself, and there's nobody in it. So I don't know if they ever will. But, man, if they do, the first three stories, and actually the fourth, because I've read the fourth as well.
Yeah.
But all four of these are very representative of the way things were doing in the Golden Age with Superman. And this third story is very, very fun usage of a lot of those same tropes to it. Yeah. It's like they turn things up to like 100 for that particular story over what they had been. So it's a good example. And then of these four, the best example so far, I think, is this third story. That's a lot of fun. Very shows you, I think, a lot of how they thought of storytelling at the time.
Yeah.
And I can even back that up by saying I have read a lot of Golden Age Batman. I'm working my way through Golden Age Wonder Woman. I've read all the appearances from the Golden Age of Dr. Fate. And they you can see a definite pattern of the time in the way all of these stories were written. Yeah. So it's very definite when you see it and somebody tells you, oh, this is this thing, you know, it's from this time period or whatever. You read other examples and it's like, oh, now I can recognize because of what they do. And these Superman stories are very much exactly how they wanted to present to people. And I guess by extension, what the people wanted from comic books. I'm not sure how you could ever figure that out without being able to talk to them at the time. But yeah, a lot of fun. Short, 14 pages, a lot of fun.
Superman 11, it's a good issue. I'm not going to talk about which, I'm not going to rank the four stories though until next time when we talk about the fourth one.
When we finish
and
it.
And then I'll rank them. Because honestly, right now, just trying to think back of what the other two stories were, for some reason, nothing is popping into my head. But yeah.
Let's see. We have Dr. Cranston and Dr. Emil, the gorilla, and the fighting the gorilla was
the giant animals. Yes.
Was the last one.
The giant animals without the giant animals.
Quickly here, the story before that was the only note I have is Rolf Zimba, which isn't much of a note. So
yeah.
I don't remember Rolf Zimba.
I'll review the other three again before we meet again and I'll be ready to give them a rank. But Superman 11 may be, of the Superman titles, maybe the top one so far because all four stories are just fun.
The best issue so far, yeah. And, you know, it's funny as we keep going that's what it turns out to be. You know, this one that's later. No, this one that's later. Rather than us looking back and say, no, man, that second issue with the, it's like, no, they just keep. I guess they keep perfecting or I don't know. I don't know why that would be. Of course, being who we are, where we are, we have a certain taste that we look for in our stories. And I still don't think, as we've been reading, that even they're really approaching anything that we consume now. I mean, it's still very distinctively Golden Age. So I'm not sure why, but as it advances, it seems that, you know, our favorite was, but now it's this. And here in a little bit, it'll happen again. It was that, but now it's that, you know, so.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I think because, what you're saying, these are not examples of great storytelling, you know, especially when you compare to books and whatnot from today. But they are good examples of great storytelling for the time. Just fun, rip-roaring yarns that just throw a bunch of shit at you that you don't have to try to defend why they, you know, they went to sleep inside the blimp. Where did they sleep? Who cares?
I don't know.
You know, it's like, these are fun. And that's, I think that's what you're saying. But I think like with a sitcom, for example, they start to learn to write for the characters.
I guess that's what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's just getting better and better about really kind of putting these wacky ideas into a 13-page story and keeping the excitement amped up. I'm sure we're going to hit some stinkers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We're going to.
I mean.
But yeah, so far, really good stuff.
But plus, too, he's writing some other stuff, too, while he's writing Superman.
Oh, yeah.
He's doing some other characters with other attributes and things, and maybe that is helping him. He sees something and does something. And he's like, "Oh man, I should try that with Superman with this character." And then so,
yeah, I'd really love to see if anybody knows where you can get a look at any of his. You know, have they ever published any of his scripts? I'd love to see.
Oh yeah, I don't know
if he does detailed stuff, what or kind, if it's more like the Marvel method, or I'd really love to see how that all
I don't know. Maybe you'd have to read some of the biographies that have come out about him. Maybe they would go into his process somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah. I'll do some research. But if anybody listening knows, let me know. All right, you ready to wrap this sucker up?
Let's wrap.
In our next episode, Count Burgak's bid to wed heiress Patricia Randall explodes into a pulpy web of graft, impersonation, and death-defying peril. Automobiles hurled off cliffs, a fall from a plane, and cliffhangers aplenty, as Clark Kent races to untangle the conspiracy before the next shocking reveal. That's coming up on episode 93 when Ed and I take a look at the plot of Count Burgak, the fourth and final Superman tale that appeared in Superman number 11, published by DC Comics in May of 1941.
I apologize most sincerely for the interruption, but I'm afraid that it was necessary due to a change in schedule. The boys will not, in fact, be looking at the plot of Count Burgak. Instead, well, I'm afraid it's a bit of a secret, and I've promised not to tell. Sorry.
So until next time, folks, I'm Steven, that's Ed, and this was the Superman Super Show. Thanks for listening.
Ciao.
We want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Superman Super Show. Questions and comments can be directed to the Superman Super Show at gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. The Superman Super Show is a presentation of Steven or Else Media. For more nerdy content just like this, check out somanypodcasts.com or use the link in your show notes. Superman is a registered trademark of DC Comics and was created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster.
Superman is a copyrighted feature appearing in Action Comics magazine.
Superman's bad. I mean, he was bad.